netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. At SIGGRAPH in New Orleans, in an FX Guide TV episode, we talked with Sony Picture Image Works about their open source initiative. Today, Mike Seymour will talk with Disney about PTEX, their open source project. PTEX is a highly optimized texture format and filtering library, and Mike goes direct to the developers to get an in-depth technical discussion about PTEX. This is a great trend we're seeing, where companies develop technology inside the company and then take an active role in the community to see what that technology can do once it's more widely adopted in the industry. In this interview, Mike will talk with three people. Let me introduce them for you. First, he'll talk with Andy Hendrickson, Disney's animation CTO, and then Brent Burley, principal engineer and the creator of PTEX, and finally, Dan Kindela, head of software at Disney Animation Studios. Some of you may remember his name as part of the original Shake team at Nothing Real. So now let's cross to Mike.
And I'm joined on the line by Andy. Andy, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
So this is a really interesting piece of technology that has just moved into the open source community. That's really, I think, what became aware in the community came aware outside of Disney around 2008, 2009. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's been in use at Disney for a little while now, and we've just recently released it as open source.
And I'm aware, I think, that Bolt was one of the big first productions that actually used it in earnest?
Yes, Bolt did. It was used on pretty much every character and every surface in that film.
So I guess the principal sort of overriding question is, from your point of view, what was the motivation that wanted Disney to move in this direction? Was it ease of use? Was it speed and production pipeline issues? Or was it just technical quality?
Well, yes to all of those. So it turns out PTEX is a great way to assign textures onto computer graphics surfaces, onto model surfaces. At Disney, we apply a very painterly approach to how we create images, and so we're quite texture heavy, probably more texture heavy than a lot of other studios. And so Brent came up with this genius idea of how to assign textures in a much more speedy, flexible, efficient way, if you will, and it allows us to really excel at applying textures. Most texturing technology hasn't changed a whole lot in the last decade or so. And so this is probably one of the biggest advances that's gone forward with that.
Yeah, we'll talk to Brent in a second about the specifics, but I guess one of the huge benefits is actually its ease of setup in terms of instead of introducing a whole extra layer into the workflow pipeline, this is actually an entire technique that effectively eases up the workflow pipeline and requires things to be less one after another and can be done a little more in parallel because of the ease of setup time on an individual model, if I understand correctly?
Yeah, that is correct. You don't have to mess around with a lot of UV assignments and UV directions. You don't have to use other people use techniques like projection painting, which are very cumbersome and create a lot of issues, particularly if you have models with that are round or models that have a lot of hidden occluding surfaces. You have to go back and project many, many maps. That's really painful and time-consuming. This system allows you to kind of easily assign the textures onto models, and it's very flexible.
So once Brent and presumably others worked on getting this fully up to speed, production ready, how fast did it take you to actually have this move in as the standard workflow through your pipeline?
Well, we brought it in. We brought it in on a short, kind of right before using it on Bolt, and it came through pretty fast. It took us a little bit to get our internal tools running, but then when it was going, artists really ate it up.
And what short was that?
What short was that, guys?
Glago's Guest.
Yeah, Glago's Guest. That's right.
Which I think was great, by the way. I saw that at SIGGRAPH. It was terrific.
Yeah, great. The test of any good technology is that the artist community eats it up quickly and can't imagine life without it. And this is one of those pieces of technology.
And so it moved then from being something that you had internally. You published some papers about it, which obviously got a lot of people very interested. And then now, as we mentioned, I think at the outset, it's moved into the open source community. We'll talk to Dan in a second about that. But generally, is this indicative of a change of climate in terms of how Dizzy works? What's the motivation to go open source?
Well, there's a couple of them, really, but primarily there are different sets of technology that have different sets of values to us at Disney. There's certainly things that we create that allow us to put images on the screen that nobody's seen before and we consider secrets, and we like to keep those in-house. But there's also a broad range of technologies that are more useful and have more value to us, either in industry goodwill or promoting a standard, that really should be open source. And so we've recently identified that, hey, this is the way modern businesses operate, and Disney wants to be a modern business and is a modern business, so we're pushing things back into the community like that. You've seen other things like this, like Yahoo, UI Toolkit, Google Codebase. There's quite a few of these things that are essentially open source freeware that can really help other people, and that industry goodwill is very, very valuable to us. So that's why we decided to put this out there. It seemed like a very good idea. It seemed like something we could keep secret if we wanted to, but it had more advantage to us in giving away in goodwill in the community than it did holding it a secret. So we did it.
Brilliant. Well, if I could swap to talking to Brent now, if he's on the line, just about how it actually works. So the thing about PTEX is that it seems to be that if you try and explain it in terms of simple terms, it's not immediately apparent why it's so beneficial, because you can understand doing texturing and stuff with a pelt model. You can use it with texture projection models. But what it seems to be is that you've developed this as a very hardcore production tool that's capable of handling extremely complex models. How far have you pushed it, and how true is it that it's able to operate at the high end?
So we push everything through PTEX, and it had to scale, or it wouldn't have been adopted. It had to work for everything. And I think that's really one of the key strengths, is that it's going to work. You don't have to think about it anymore. One of the things that, before you'd have to think about each model, is this going to be a problem with UVs? What's our strategy going to be? Do we have to take these considerations in when we model it? And now it's just something that nobody thinks about. And we did have some problem cases that came up with our old method that were really pushing the limits of doing UV textures or doing any other kind of texturing method. And just in terms of the number of surfaces, the complexity of the geometry and the topology, the number of faces, we've used PTEX for surface texturing, but we also use it for baking on larger objects like trees. We have a system where we bake out lighting information, and it's storing information per leaf. Even though the leaves are instanced, the lighting information is unique per leaf, so the textures are much more complex than the geometry. And so we have, upwards of a million textures in one file, and we have, I don't know if we're up into millions of textures, but it wouldn't surprise me. And it scales. There aren't any problems with scaling because of the way the system was designed.
So at its core, it eliminates UV assignment. How does it do that, and how does it manage it so that it can be done efficiently? Because, of course, as you just pointed out, we're talking about a large data set.
So the assignment, I think somebody pointed out, at first we called this a UV-less texturing system, and somebody pointed out that wasn't correct. There's still UVs, and it's true. So we call them per-face UVs. And we still have textures, and they're 2D textures with a UV coordinate system. But if you consider a model that's made up just of quad faces, which is predominantly what we model with, each quad is a little rectangle that's been stretched in some way, and it has an implicit UV 0-1 space. And so every quad on a model gets its own texture, and you may have 10,000 or 100,000 textures that it takes to cover that model. And what we've done is just make that very efficient to do. So each texture, it might be as little as a single color sample if it's a very small face, or it might be as high of resolution as, I think right now we go up to 4K by 4K, so about 16 million texels on a single face. The system can go higher than that, so if you're baking, you could bake as high as you want. And as far as how that's done efficiently, there's no magic there. It's just a lot of engineering, and I think one of the things that works to its advantage is that since everything's done per face, it's working in a way that's parallels what the renderer's doing, which the renderer gets a big surface, and it starts working through it per face. At least this is how RenderMan works. And it processes a face, and it turns it into grids, and it shades the grids. And so we access the textures in a way that just goes right along with what the renderer is doing. And the file layout internally is also, a lot of thought was put into the organization to provide the data in an order that's consistent with how the renderer is likely to ask for it. So when you're rendering something up close, the data, all the data for the high res is in one place, and when you render far away, all the low res data is in one place. And when it's really far away, then every face just has a single sample, and all those get all the single value per face values get stored in a single part of the file. So it's especially efficient when things are far away, and when you have a big set, most of the stuff is far away. So there's a big efficiency win overall when you consider that.
So, of course, we're not just after, removing seam lines and stuff. You need to have anisotropic stuff that works really well in terms of just the actual quality of the filtering. Can you talk to me about some of the filtering aspects of PTEC?
Sure. So, one thing that it's very good at, actually, is anisotropic filtering. And, again, this gets back to being a design that parallels what the renderer does. So when the renderer is dicing up these faces into shading grids, it's doing that in a way that follows the UVs of each face. It's hard to do without a whiteboard. So you can imagine that each, it's called a micropolygon, is a little rectangular piece of a face. And the ideal filter shape for shading that micropolygon grid is that little rectangle. And because the textures are aligned with that, then the rectangular filter, is a aligned rectangle in the texture space. And that's a very efficient form of anisotropic filtering. Also, with the rectangular filter, we can use a sharpening filter that wouldn't really work if we didn't have this rectangular filter footprint. And so we have started using a sharpening filter for our color textures, and that's something that wasn't available in RenderMan before. And we weren't really sure how this would play out, but we turned it to a fairly sharp setting and just left it, and I think it never. I mean, how do I want to say this?
But I mean, on that filtering side of things, shouldn't the filtering be based on the sort of screen pixels rather than the shading? I mean, in terms of the texturing.
There is a question about that, and that is an option, and we do support that. But you actually get sharper results if you base it on the shading grid. RenderMan is already going to filter the micropolygons using the pixel filter, and so you're just shading, you're computing your filtering in the same space that you would be, computing your shading in the same space that the geometry is being filtered. But there are some cases where you do want to use the screen space projection, and you can do that. You just don't get as sharp of a filtering result. So this was a question that came up a few times about because that's a fairly common thing to do is to use the screen space pixel. But because we use displacement so much, that screen space projection may not be where that micropolygon ends up after you displace it. And so the screen space projection might not be valid for shading when you use displacements.
Right. So so in terms of actual setup, a huge benefit comes from just almost the lack of setup. How does that actually happen? What actually is the process that that a texture artist or a look development artist goes through?
They get a model out of modeling. It has no UVs. They load it into our paint system. They start painting, and they save it, and that file is ready for rendering. There's no extra conversion steps. I guess the only real setup that you would have to consider is determining the texture resolution. And so we have a number of tools for doing that. We determine a default resolution when you, anytime you load a model, and that's just based on, you know, filling the model in a full camera frame and using a default camera size and then figuring out what the, you know, the optimal texel size is for that. And from there, you can just hit a key to step everything up to a higher resolution if you want to. Another method we have is you can load the actual camera move that you intend to use, and it will look at every frame of the camera move and figure out the optimal resolution for that. But I think what generally happens is artists tend to just load their model, and they hit plus until they run out of memory or just about run out of memory. And they paint, and then they save it, and they tend to over-res things because, you know, they may get a camera move and layout may say, oh, we'll never get closer than so-and-so. And then, you know, when they change their mind and they do, you know, I think the look artist would rather have resolution to spare. And so as long as it's not slowing them down, they generally over-res things by quite a bit. And, you know, it stores things fairly efficiently, and even though we have a huge number of textures and they're really high res, it's a drop in the bucket in terms of our production data.
So I guess the question, the last question for you is really about topology, and are there special cases or cases that it doesn't work in? How general is the application?
Initially, we didn't support non-quad faces. And that's something that we've added. So we now support non-quad faces.
I think RenderMan takes non-quad faces and converts them, right? I mean,
right. So we followed, again, we followed what the renderer is doing internally. So following the Catmull-Clark subdivision, when you subdivide a mesh once, all non-quads become quads. If you have a pentagon, that pentagon becomes five quads.
Yeah.
And so we do the same thing, but only for non-quad faces. So if it started out as a quad, it gets one texture. If it started out as a non-quad, then it gets N textures. And that was a trivial change to make to PTEX for the file format. There's really just a flag to say whether a texture is coming from a non-quad face. The only tricky part was handling the filtering across the quad non-quad boundary, because now you have a T junction that didn't used to be there. But that was just working through the details. The basic algorithms stayed the same. So now we can handle really any model. So topology-wise, there are no topology restrictions. So it really doesn't matter. If it's a valid subdivision surface, it's going to work. We also use it on poly surfaces. Although with poly surfaces, you don't have that. There's no mapping for non-quads, so they really just have to be quads to start with.
Well, thanks so much for that. If I can talk to Dan now for a second, just about sort of a more slightly go back up in slight overview. I think one of the things we just were discussing, obviously, then with Brent, is the fact that the workflow has changed. And I guess from your perspective, head of the software group, it must be reassuring to know that you've kind of removed that bottleneck where, I don't know, people that needed to get on and start doing things had to wait until Look Dev could set up UVs. And that must have eased up kind of how people go about using the software.
Yes, and it's like in just looking at applying software anywhere in the pipeline, you want to create better workflows so people can have more iterations and end up with a higher quality product in the end. So in doing this, this is it's a common problem that we were facing, or it's a common problem that we're facing within the industry, and we weren't alone with that. And from our perspective, the industry was headed in this direction, and we had a big breakthrough, and we thought other vendors would. Or we thought vendors of 3D paint packages would end up having breakthroughs as well.
So Brent was talking about the fact that the method is so in sync with, say, RenderMan. And, in fact, Pixar was one of the early partners which led to this being adopted in RenderMan's Pro Server, correct?
Yes. Our pipeline. So we built this technology within our pipeline, and we use RenderMan as our pipeline, and we share a lot of code with Pixar Studio. And as they started to adopt pieces of it, we saw value for working with the RenderMan Render Group, the PRMan Group, and they had an interest in what that could bring to them as well.
So there's one thing to work with the PR group, which of course is directly relevant, but you've extended this out now as a company to really being open source, and this invites companies that are maybe perhaps making paint texturing packages, and I know that obviously texturing is sometimes done completely different people to look dev, but still both use high-core professional packages that could really benefit from this technology. Are you able to discuss anyone that's looking actually incorporating this into more of an application that anyone would be able to get their hands on?
So there's a company called or a product called 3D Coat that's out there, and they have an alpha or beta version of their 3D paint package already supporting this. And so I'm not advocating them, but
sure.
they saw when it was released, they were really excited about it, and they implemented it really quickly.
And in fact, from our discussions, we know a number of the vendors are very enthusiastic about, in fact, without exception, enthusiastic about the work that PTX has done. You must have had really good feedback from the industry.
Yes, we have. And we've been in discussions with a number of vendors. I'm not at liberty to talk about details. But in going through this, it was about a year and a half ago when we decided that we want to drive it towards becoming an open source standard. And so we started contacting vendors and talking with them and going through its advantages. And we've had a lot of very optimistic responses. And so we expect to see authoring tools starting to appear on the market with this support.
So is there some way, I mean, how does this work? Is there an API? How does it actually happen with people outside your immediate Disney group?
So there's an API, and it's available under a BSD open source license at ptex.us. And it's a library for accessing the file format, and it includes caching and filtering. From it a simple state of integrating it into an application, it could just be an importer and exporter. But if you take it to the next level, which is what we've done, an application wouldn't have to require having UVs assigned.
And I think there were, nine vendors or studios that got involved as sort of a fairly early on group of senior serious companies?
Yes. So we had prior to releasing it as open source, we licensed it individually to these studios and vendors, and it wasn't all at once. It was more like piecemeal. And as other companies found out about it, and we started reaching out and talking about it more, we had a lot more interest in it. A key time period was about last year. This time at GDC, a number of people met, and we sort of outlined some adoption plans, and we followed up on those well.
Now, for an artist that's listening that obviously isn't going to be accessing an API, there is actually some work that's interestingly happening, just reaching out to everyone through the web, through DisneyAnimation.com. Do you want to talk about that for a sec?
Okay, so PTEX is an example of a much larger direction that we're headed here at Disney Animation. We recognize the need for open source within the industry. If you look around, a lot of the studios are solving the exact same problems and duplicating solutions. And in terms of open source, we'd like to be open sourcing technologies that allow us that do the mundane bits or address problems that are common through the industry, but really don't give an advantage to one place or another. So we've launched an open source site on our website to highlight pieces of technologies that we're releasing. And we've also added a publications area, which is it's a collation of all the papers that we've published, and we also have plans to be putting up white papers that would be of interest to artists and other technology people within this industry.
Yeah, I think it's a really terrific thing that that you guys are doing that, because obviously at a number of levels we go to see a film made by Disney not because of the shading per se. It's obviously a great part of the end product, but you know, it's certainly the story that tends to get most people into the theaters. And at the other end of the scale, of course, it must be easier for you if staff can move or freelancers can be hired that are familiar with your techniques, because some of these things have become more industry wide. Is it something that you know, you see being in sort of paralleled what I might call SIGGRAPH level stuff, or do you think that you'd ever get to a point that you'd release or pass over some applications or some of the in-house actual programs? Because at the moment, this is really kind of more tech than applications.
So we've been looking at other technologies in-house to open source, as I mentioned. The extent of those, I'm not sure if we'll reach a large application level. The larger the application, the less likely it is that we would tend to want to open source it, but I wouldn't rule out anything.
But I'm hearing that in part that is not anything to do with any corporate culture and just literally to do with the complexity of licensing and the legality of patents.
Yes, that's correct. We definitely want to expose technologies that can further the industry and let us focus on making better imagery.
So I'm just extending this out because this you mentioned the publications, and I'm really enthusiastic that that'll be collated into a single point. You are obviously and have been as a company publishing, but do we could we derive from this that perhaps there'd be opportunities for more, for example, SIGGRAPH papers at LA this year or whatever? In other words, is there a sense of you encouraging the team to publish more and go to more conferences in a proactive role?
Yes, absolutely. If you look at last year, we had a great showing of papers and sketches, and we even hosted a Birds of a Feather. So that's been an increased area of focus for us, building up the Disney Animation Studios technical brand, and it's like really showcasing what we've been doing in-house. If you look over the past many years, there's been a lot of really great technologies created here. But I think Disney's failed to capitalize on getting those out to the world and sharing them.
Well, again, we want to really thank you for taking time, all of you, actually, to talking to us, but also just applaud the efforts you're doing in promoting more dialogue. Because publishing this stuff, and especially PTEX, I've got to say, it's so incredibly cool and so incredibly robust in terms of its difference that it makes to a pipeline. It's not a specialist application. It's one of those big step forwards. I think somebody said earlier in the interview, one of the largest we've seen in this area in years. So thank you so much on behalf of the community.
You're welcome.
And we will hope to see you at SIGGRAPH.
We'll be there.
Well, I hope you guys enjoy these kind of deep technical talks as much as we do. The guys mentioned SIGGRAPH, but before we do that, it's a busy time coming up here at FX Guide with NAB on the horizon. We're in the home stretch here, getting close to NAB. We'll be in Vegas in full force with FX Guide TV episodes, podcasts, etc., stories, bringing you any news from the show. So that'll wrap it up. Thanks for joining us. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. Until the next podcast, make sure you check out articles and stories on fxguide.com and check out all the great course offerings at fxphd.com.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.